time, another town, another everything. It's always back to you.
All right, if it's Thursday, we're talking stuff with Tim Lynch, who's down in Texas today. Tim, how are you doing?
Doing great, Mac. Thanks for having me on again.
You bet. And Jeff Kinney, who's in Southern California. Jeff, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Mac. Thanks.
You bet. You bet. The biggest story in the news is beginning yesterday. Turkey commenced operations into Syria after the President of the United States announced that he would pull our advisors out of the area adjacent to the Turkish border, and so that has ensued. So let's talk about that real quick. Jeff, thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a good move because it's like 50 or 60 guys sitting there between, one group of two groups of people that hate each other. Kind of remind me a little bit about Beirut or anything smaller. And it's just a matter of time before, we get smeared with that crap that they're smearing each other with. So I figure it's better. We have nothing to gain, What are we going to gain any more than this? I mean, I've heard people say, well, it might be a problem with Syrian civilians. I can't think of what I care about less than Syrian civilians right now. So that's my attitude about it.
All right. Tim?
So I'm complete agreement with Jeff, and I would like to correct the record. Syria moved into Turkey moved into northern Syria on the 2nd of February 2018. They're merely extending a security zone that since February of 2018, we have been trying to broker a deal, and we've moved the Kurdish forces out of the way, and we've tried to prepare this thing, but we've been, as usually is the case, we've gone over budget, over time, and the president of Turkey told Trump, hey, I've had enough dicking around, we're moving. And so Jeff is exactly right. We just got 50 guys out of the way of something that was inevitable, and there's like, 5,000 to 10,000 ISIS prisoners involved in this swath of terrain. Let the Turks have them. My God, that's taking a tremendous problem off our hands. Because I can tell you what's going to happen if the Turks don't take care of them. We'll have to take care of them, and then it'll be like the North Korea, like that damn island off of South Korea in 1952. I mean, it's just a matter of time because we're too soft on it.
I disagree with both of you. I think the president is a clown. And I think this is a fucking clown move. And I think when the Pentagon says, yeah, we didn't know shit about this, and your allies say, we don't know shit about this, I think that's a fucking clown show. And when the United States starts acting like a clown around the United States, around the world, that's a bad thing. Now, we could discuss the merits of if we want to get out of there, who goes in there, the mechanics behind that, and all the rest of that shit, so we don't leave our allies hanging, we don't leave, none of the things that I talk about happen. So there's other ways, if you want to affect that, to do it that aren't as fucked up as what we've all watched the last few days. And you can if that's your opinion, Jeff, that let's get those guys out of there. Okay, let's do it without fucking over the people that fought with us.
Can I offer just a little bit of pushback
from a guy who said we were clowns for getting into the Iraq war after 9/11 and shit like that. Now we're clowns for finally, we have no dog in that fight. The Kurds don't want to get shot, get the fuck out of the way. Get back into Iraq. I mean, how much shit are we responsible for? Really?
And I've got another...
Hold on. So the group that was most responsible for the dying and ejecting ISIS out of Syria, who partnered with us, fuck them?
Yeah.
You don't know
okay.
that. Wait,
right.
wait, hold on a second.
Like,
back up.
Here's okay. the thing. It's not fuck them. We're just moving these guys out of the way. We got to do... It's either all or nothing with people like you, Mac. Say, hey, no. We're just not going to fucking be in Syria anymore, in that part of Syria. That's it. Doesn't mean we're abandoning all the Kurds and shit like that. It's overly dramatic. And you think that President Trump's a clown? I'll tell you, he's the least clownish of the last five motherfuckers we had in there.
Well, let me tell you this. He's, in my opinion, this shit is as clown-like, right? And Lindsey Graham, who I think we're all fans of, right? He said, "Look, this is the kind of shit President Obama fucking did, and that's what created ISIS."
Hold on a second. Number one, let me stick it for the record. That I was forbidden to talk to Lindsey Graham by Dave Furness when they came to your camp and I was there. So I'm no fan of his. Number two, what is Trump supposed to do? If he's going to ask the Pentagon, hey, what's your opinion on this? What do you think they're going to say? You know what they're going to say. Well, sir, we're going to have a little analysis with paralysis here, and we're going to tell you we need to stay. We always need to stay. We might need to increase. If he has an NSC meeting and he brings in the CIA and the NSC and everybody else, they're going to leak. Right now, he's dealing with an impeachment based on a transcript which you can read for yourself. As being innocuous,
any of that.
I don't give a shit about. I don't give a shit about any of that, Tim. We're talking about Syria.
Yeah,
no, well, I know that. But we're at war with the president. His hand. Who can he trust? Who can he trust? He's got to make the decision. If you ask Joe Dunford, he'll always say we need to stay there and shepherd this thing. But Joe Dunford's not the president. Only Trump is. And he had to make a decision. I think he made a ballsy one because you know what the Pentagon was going to say. And if you start talking to the NSC, it all leaks out and comes out in an accusation in Congress against him built on nothing. And we're dealing with this for the third time now in his administration. And what do you think that has on the perceptions overseas of American power? It's not good. As a country, for our country I'm talking about.
So because of leaks that happen all the time, this is why he acted the way he acted.
No, because he already knew what they're going to tell him. Why would I go ask them for their advice when we already know? They've been working this problem for a year. This isn't the first time Trump's been dealing with that strip of land. For a year, they've been working with Turkey, trying to reach a compromise so Turkey won't do what Turkey said that they're going to do, which is what they just did, and we got our 50 guys out of the goddamn way. That's the first time in a long time we've done something smart like that, and I'm happy to see it done. And I'm just saying, right now, the dysfunctions with Congress. If you want to stop this shit, there's a way of doing it. It's the Congress using the War Power Act. They awarded themselves in the 70s and have never used since. They're the ones that are supposed to put the brakes on this shit. And if you want the White House to stop unilaterally making decisions and doing weird shit, Congress is supposed to take care of that. And they've abdicated that responsibility for 18 years in a row. That's the problem.
I don't disagree with you, and the three of us talked about this before, about the War Powers Act, and if Congress isn't all in, the fact that the guy who runs for president says, I'm going to get us out of these wars, blah, 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 and even if it's not in, right, the long-term best interest of the country, you know, President Obama, in fact, I don't know what I watched here in the last couple of weeks, you know, he went down to, what, Camp Lejeune and made a fucking speech down there about, today I can stand before you and say, we're out of Iraq. And there's kind of, everybody looks around and then people start clapping, you know, and he made his big speech down there. And I don't know. Let me tell you, I think the course of action is not a good one. I think the way we went about it is terrible, right? And I'm honestly, I'm surprised that both of you support it.
I'm not surprised. Think that Trump's going to stand by and let them shellack the guys that we were working with the ISIS. There's different kinds of Kurds over there, to include a Kurdish group that is legitimately designated by our State Department as a terrorist organization. So we don't know which Kurds they're thumping. But they've been thumping them for a year now, since 2018. So this is not new. It's just, the only thing that's new is all of a sudden it breaks in the press as we're abandoning the guys that defeated ISIS. Oh, bullshit. There's no way we're going to let them go after guys we've been working with. I don't believe that for a second.
So
President Trump, nobody ever, there's nobody putting lipstick on any of Trump's pigs. Everything he does is portrayed in the worst possible light. Whereas everything the magic Obama did was portrayed in the best light, even by conservative news outlets. They just, you don't want to be a guy who went crossways with the first black president. And yet now, almost everybody loves to crap on this guy. I mean, who can he trust?
We're talking to three of us. So I don't know what that has to do with the course of action, but okay.
No. All I'm saying is we don't know which Kurds are getting thumped there because we don't know which Kurds we made drug deals with. But there is one guy who does know exactly who the players are, and the only guy I'll listen to on the subject, and that's John Allen. That's exactly who knows. But until I hear him weigh in on what exactly is going on the ground, I'm not going to assume that we're going to stand by and let the Turks take on guys that just stumped ISIS, because they're not going to be able to thump them anyway, for God's sakes. The Kurds aren't those sissies. They've got anti-air missiles. They've got artillery.
You can't even trust generals anymore, like retired generals. They are the biggest, you know, welfare state dudes in the world. I mean, listen, look at Colin Powell. Oh, we're in a shambles. He don't know shit about what's going on. You know, it's like, according to him, as soon as we go to war with somebody, no matter what kind of egregious thing they did to us, we own their future. For now, we have to make sure they get back on their feet. Bullshit. Bullshit. That's why we get screwed all the time. That's why we're like, what is it, almost $20 trillion in debt right now? Because we're always throwing money and staying too long and doing dumb shit. You know, forget about it. Get out of there.
Well, it's actually...
down the border. That's where we need people.
It's Colin Powell's lack of moral courage that has spawned all this.
That's absolutely true.
If he would have done what he was supposed to do, which he said he believed, that we should not go to war in Iraq... because you're going to own it if you break it. The Colin Powell school, the Pottery Barn school of Colin Powell, at the end of the day, he bowed and said, okay, instead of resigning, I will take your weak shit. And Tenet has to sit behind me when I present it to the UN. So people will know where this shit came from. Even though I don't believe it. I mean, as to me, Jeff said, we've talked about this before. Every one of these things, not to be distracted, but we've been escorted by the flag officers of the American military.
Yeah.
And
I would point out that most countries seeing Tenet sit behind them would have known it was bullshit. Oh, the CIA guy? Oh, no, this has got to be bullshit. They've never been right on anything.
It's like, you know, to me, I thought we went into Iraq, I thought we're going to go into every country where there's a shithead, you know, dictator in charge. Every one of these Muslim countries say either you cough up terrorists or we're coming in. And, you know, probably going into Iraq probably wasn't, we should have put the squeeze on Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. So I think they're the real culprits behind that thing. But, you know, we didn't. So what we should have done is, I mean, what about this? You know, you grab enough of their oil revenues and you grab some of those oil refiners and stuff and you drain the thing until we pay for the money we spent in there. We thoroughly compensate the, you know, families in the Marine Corps case, like 42 or something like that, who are KIA and OIF-1. You make a handsome profit and then you leave. And you leave the place a mess. Who cares? You think they'd give a shit about us?
Then we'd be the Chinese.
Yeah, we just became
the Chinese. No, it wouldn't be the Chinese, because everybody in America has the right to, you know, to bitch about it, has the right to say whatever he wants, has the right to vote for the next guy.
It doesn't sound like you're talking about a representative democracy when you describe the course of action overseas.
No.
Okay. And nobody needs those refineries, brother. We've got plenty of our own. They're new.
Not for the whole goddamn world. We act in our self-interest, and we're finally starting to do that. And all of this here is the opposite of that. He doesn't want to be involved at all, and Nathan's going to shed American blood for no good reason. He hates that.
All right. There you have it. Let's talk about General Cini's interview. All right.
Okay.
We'll go around. We'll start with Tim. Tim, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, General Zinni was on, and then General Van Riper made a guest appearance at the end of it, and which I loved, by the way, and it was really cool. We're talking about discipline. It's the On Discipline series where General Mattis has been involved in it, General Halick, General Van Riper, and now General Zinni. And so the interview is about 2.5 hours, 2 hours of General Zinni talking discipline, which is I love, and then General Van Riper. I thought it would be great to have General Van Riper on because of some of the things that General Zinni said, and I'd love to hear them disagree and footnote shit and stuff like that. So I called him. He said, "Sure, I'll do it." So anyway, that if you haven't listened to that, you have to listen to it. So anyway, with all of that said, Timmy, what did you pull out of that?
Well, the first thing I noticed was that General Zinni had a hell of a lot of FMF time. It's a remarkable amount of time he was able to spend in the fleet reinforces during those critical years, you know, from the lieutenant up to major and whatnot. But the other thing I remember about that combat concepts class, because I was there that night, the same night that you taped that, and I saw that class. And the one thing I remember the most about it was basically like watching a 2.5 hour comic sketch. And I'm talking like a professional, no kidding, serious comic. His timing and his material had us at times, I mean, literally in tears. We were laughing so hard. So he was talking about a subject which couldn't be goddamn serious, you know, how exactly you're going to go about employing your men to kill other men and whatnot, and talking about the training and the rules and the organizational ethos and all these other kind of things. But he had a delivery that would have made him $1 million on a Netflix special. And I say that only because I remember the point he made about I was trying to establish how I wanted you to know how I thought and why we're going to work at this consensus together versus somebody like Van Riper who issues rules and said this is how it's going to be. Because they weren't different under Zinni. You still standardized your gear and stuff like that. The thing that separated General Zinni is there's just not that many people that have the ability to synthesize that kind of material and deliver it in a way that was as I remember it, was fucking hysterical. I mean, crying laughing. I remember that clearly about that stuff. And he's such a unique guy. And that's why I thought it was interesting because he didn't want to say Van Riper's wrong and my approach is right. He never said that. But I remember him discussing that in that concepts class. I remember trying to emulate that at times. But I don't have that sense of humor. I mean, Jesus, he's good. I mean, he's really good.
One of the funniest things that he says that night is, and this was in my head and was the reason why I asked General Van Riper to come back on and comment on it. He talks about the PME program that he installed with 9th Marines. And he said, you know, we're not encumbered by dependents out there. So it can be more robust. We can do more evening stuff. And we do. And he said, and I teach it. I teach, you know, the officers' classes, the leader classes, you know, 9th Marines. And so really Combat Concepts is a series of his presentations that he did. But anyway, he said, and one night I brought these, you know, I had speakers, and one night I had this panel. I had Bill Fike, I had John Ripley, and I had General Van Riper. He said, these guys, great guys, ship not full of silver stars and Navy crosses, and they asked him a question, and they all answered it in a different way, and it blew their vacuum tubes, right? And he said, well, he didn't say their names yet, and he said, one, right, they called the surfer, one they called the philosopher, and one they called the Prussian. And now General Van Riper is a brigadier general. He's sitting over to the left of the stage that Zinni's on in Haywood, in the chow hall at the basic school. And he's sitting there with Bill Lynn sitting next to him. And Zinni looks at Van Riper and says, don't wax your board, General. And as Timmy said, the whole fucking place, like, falls out. Because here he is in public, busting the most uptight white dude on the planet, General Van Riper's balls in public. And we don't realize, nobody knows that they're great friends and to this day are still great friends. But as Tim said, I mean, it was hilarious. But I saw him months later, and I wanted more of Ginzo from Philly, right, being an evangelist. And what I saw the next time I saw him was intellectual, you know, kind of soft-spoken, very deliberate guy. And I was like, what the fuck happened? And, you know, obviously what I learned was that he, as Tim said, he synthesizes his personality, his intellect, his combat experiences, and his desire to influence. And then he knows how to read the audience, and he communicates on their frequency.
Right.
Right. And that's what he's phenomenal about. And that's why he's the fucking burning bush.
That's right. When I first got to IOC, I never heard of the guy until you and Paul Kennedy were talking about him. And Paul had been a lieutenant in 3-9 when they went to Oki.
Right.
And he was the, 3-9 was part of the 7th Marines then. But, when they went over to Oki, he was in those PMEs. He said, General Zinni. Not only that, he would, like, they would wrestle and shit like that, you know? You know, he was, he's very, very good with young officers.
Right.
Sure.
Right. No, and so I mean, talk about being a geek. In the middle of these interviews, it's like, for me, it's like, this is the best to be able to sit, you know, and discuss these kind of issues and get their thoughts and whatnot. I want to, you know, Jeff, any thoughts? Give me a thought after listening to that.
Well, I like listening to General Zinni's interview with you a lot. What really struck me, though, and he's talking about being an advisor, he's talking about that was his most fascinating tour,
right?
Because, you know, he was going all around that part of South Vietnam, seeing different leadership styles from people in another culture, you know? And that takes a certain amount of... think about General Zinni. He's the type of guy who listens to what you say when you say it, and he gives you respect for who you are. And that's why he was effective in that job he had in Somalia, talking with those guys, because he never gave the impression, I'm here to change you and teach you how to be, you know, like an American. He just wasn't that way, and that's why he was effective. I think that's why he ended up being tapped to do some of the high-level diplomacy stuff he did after he retired, you know?
No, to me, his gift is as a communicator.
And
but he's equally gifted, as Jeff said. And I would venture to say that tour as an advisor, he tells a story in the interview about a guy who he crossed paths with that might have been a battalion commander or a company commander who'd been in the South Vietnamese army for like 30 years or some shit like that. And he was like a company commander. This guy, and he goes, he had been with the French, he had been with, and he goes through all the different organizations the dude had been with. And he said, this dude was harder than woodpecker lips, you know?
Yeah.
And he knew his business, and he knew how to do it, because he'd been fighting for like 25 of the 30 years. And so it was amazing.
Something else about General Zinni, though, if I could just throw in this.
Yeah.
He was talking one time about being a battalion commander of 2-8. And in those days, the next battalion commander was the XO. And he's at CAX. And he says, holy shit, you know, I'm going to need the spare...
engineers. It's engineers.
Yeah, right. And he gets on the radio, and he's going to call back to the XO, who happens to be Ray Smith. And Ray Smith calls him and goes, I know you want the engineers.
What he says is, he said the only guy I ever knew who had a gift for this is Ray Smith. Mm-hmm. And then he tells the story that Jeff said, because the guy actually, you know, they had Bangalore teams, right? Well, he creates two additional Bangalore teams in case these don't go. They have additional teams that can support it. And Zinni says, smart guy. One of those did not go. And then when it didn't go, I reached for the handset, and Smith says, I know you want the other Bangalore team. He says, I dropped the handset. He said, but Smith used to do this shit to me all the time. He had a gift for this. And again, like Timmy said, the way he does it is funny as fuck.
Yeah. You know, that's one thing about General Smith, that he would say, you asshole lieutenants, listen to, monitor the net. Just because you're not doing something, you're going to find out, you can find out more shit from listening to what's going on to other people. He learned that in Vietnam, you know?
Right.
You know, somebody else's war is like two clicks away, but it could become your war pretty fast, you know? And it sounds like a simple thing, But I'll tell you, it takes discipline. You know, it takes love of your craft, really.
You know what? You're right. And those guys, you know, they're amazing guys. Zinni and Smith, who were in the same basic school class, right? Butch Neal and Marty Steele, I think, was too, who became a lieutenant general.
Yeah.
Those guys, you know, Smith fluent in Vietnamese, which is not something that American people do, right? I mean, it's not an easy language. And they still get together, right?
Yeah.
They still get together with the Vietnamese officers that they supported as advisors. They do reunions, and they're incredibly devoted. I mean, so these guys are great men, you know, great men who happen to be Marines, and it was our good fortune, you know, to cross paths with them in some way, shape, or form. My career, incredible. I remember sitting there that night. I had never seen an officer like Tony Zinni in my life.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, who the fuck is this guy? First of all, everything he's saying is the fucking truth, right? Everything he's saying, like, you know, he does this thing about challenge and password. He said, you know, we can't get the, he goes, let me back up the sergeant major, the first sergeant. We can't get the theory right, and now we've even fucked up the techniques. And he does this little spiel about the Australian peel. He said, my guy's coming to me with this shit. He said, then they tell me about the Australian peel, right? What is it, some strip show in Kinville? And then he says, and now we've even, you know, we had a good system for a challenge and password, and we've even fucked that up. You know, now everybody's James Bond. The moon is blue. How are you? Right? And you're sitting there, and you're sitting there like going, who the fuck is this guy who understands the whole thing and how stupid the shit we're asked to do is?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But, you know, he would do stuff. He said a couple things through the years I didn't agree with. And the reason I didn't agree with him is because he didn't put it in context.
Right.
Like, he was talking about working in Somalia. He goes, I love a big staff because... And what he didn't say, I think a big staff suck, but if half of them drop dead most of the time, you don't even know the difference. But what he's talking about is when you don't have clarity of mission from the National Command Authority, you need a lot of guys to cover, you know, the weird shit that comes along. You know, when you're dealing with NGOs and things like that, and he was right about that, you know? But he's not going to say, hey, when the president's an asshole, you need a big staff, you know?
Right. Well, and you don't know before you go do it.
Yeah.
The other thing that, you know, I know that people disagree, you know, vehemently with was his whole stance about control measures and fire support coordination measures and things like that. And, you know, I think the more you listen to him, you know, he knows they're necessary. But what he's doing by taking the stance that he makes you fight for what's necessary, and he makes sure that I'm going to go talk to Jeff before we put some kind of restricted fire measure in, and we're both going to go to him and say, hey, we need this. And that way, he forces a horizontal communication, which is the whole point of it, and we have the minimum that holds us back as possible. But you don't, when you first hear it, you're like, what the fuck?
Because we all had that hammered at us during CACs, during the 80s and early 90s. CACs, they were Nazis on that, and they never really understood that the whole point of it was when you couldn't do what you just saying that General Zinni was going to do first. And the whole reason we had CACs was because of the Easter Offensive in 72. They had Turley set that up, who was the senior advisor in Vietnam during the Easter Offensive. And all those guys, and guys who know them, like Smith and Livingston and Ripley, they understood what Colonel Turley's driving and what the point of it was. But it got... Once he left, once he retired, it got perverted into this thing of we're going nuts trying to do the non-standard SEAD mission. We had him at the IOC. I don't know if you guys remember.
Hold on. Explain to everybody what SEAD is.
SEAD is the suppression of enemy air defense. And so to move forward, you want to suppress the enemy air so that you can fly in big ordnance on fixed-wing aircraft. And in order to do that, you'd use your indirect fire assets to suppress them being able to shoot at the aircraft. In other words, there'd be like a ZSU-23-4, which is a four-barrel automatic series of cannon on a radar-mounted chassis of an armored vehicle that the Soviets gave to them, their proxies, and that they had. And it was a real threat to any kind of aircraft. So the idea was to suppress them, smoke them, hit them with, with white phosphorus and fragmentation ordnance, so that they wouldn't aim too good when your birds came in to deliver the killing blow that would allow you to move forward in the assault. And that became, I don't know if you guys remember, the whole battalion of guys trying not to die of heat stroke, you know, sleeping in AAVs in the desert, 110 degrees, while these four earnest dudes in the FAC, the mortar forward observer, the artillery forward observer, some guy trying to coordinate the whole thing called the fire support team leader, trying to do this window, this mythical window to do this because of the perversion of the stuff that General Zinni's talking about.
And if you don't, I got into an argument about aiming stakes right when I got to the basic school. And what I was arguing for now in retrospect was, we don't teach the utility and when to use them and why to use them, right? All we do is we want to see two pieces of wood and a yoke stake, right? I got into this argument and I said, no, it should be emblematic of the organization of the ground. They should look at you and say, no, but do I need to physically limit my weapon? If I don't, then I'm not going to do it. Because if you make me do that shit, as soon as the shooting starts, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to throw that shit away. But if Timmy's down the hill with Jeff and they're in an OP, and there's a chance that I may shoot him, then I need to have something, right, that indicates that in front of me. Maybe it's a sandbag. Maybe it's a stick that blocks my weapon, or two sticks, right, that keep me from swinging my weapon into that space. But I said, that's what we need to teach. We're not teaching any of that shit. And
we had Colonel Dabney come out and talk about Hill A-81. Hmm. And he used that stuff, he said, because it was the blackness of that part of Vietnam is so black.
Right.
Basically, what they're trying to do is imitate the machine gun's FPL. You know, the M6 machine gun on a tripod, when you go to the FPL, you're slamming either all the way to the left or all the way to the right.
Right.
And that's your aiming, that's your limiting thing. That means the gun is on its trajectory.
And again, to what Jeff was saying, that TTP comes from pitch black nights, right?
And
how you organize the ground to defend yourself. And my point, I think, which is Zinni's point, is if you don't teach the conceptual understanding behind that shit, they're not going to do it. They don't see the utility in it. It's just fucking harassment. So you got to teach the why part of this so you don't wind up doing stupid shit with, 1,153 guys, right, trying not to fucking die of heat stroke so four guys can do something.
Right. It's like mass, man. You're like, you don't know why you're saying the Apostles' Creed. You don't know why you're doing but you are, because that's how it goes. And so a lot of the shit we were doing was just because that's what we do.
Right.
I want to do this.
And again, so that's in my opinion, that was the magic of General Zinni, because he was constantly, pushing the why piece of it. He wanted you, well, why? And what are the footnotes behind it? And why are we doing that? And he talks about when he was an advisor going back through bunker complexes. And he does this, one of the funniest things he does is this skit about Range 5 and then going to Vietnam. And he says, in Quantico I got taught, the battlefield was a linear place. I'm always in boxes, right? I'm in bowling alleys, right? And I've got terrain objectives. He said, I get to Vietnam, and they never conveniently dangle a flank off the side of the hill that I can get to, right? They're not in a linear position. I went through those things when I was a dumbass lieutenant captain because I thought I would see them again. And they were all, they were in positions that were X's. So you hit it from one direction, right? Boom. You got hit from two sides. I went to envelop it, like they taught me in Quantico, and I got hit from two more sides again. I went to do a turning movement, and I couldn't get around this son of a bitch.
And yes, right? FED mentality.
Right, so yeah, so you're listening to it, going, wow, so maybe I have to blast a flank into it? Is that how it works? Like, what do I do? How do I take that down? But that's the kind of shit that he taught you, you know, and made you think about your craft, which is really cool, And this thing we talk about discipline. So let me play audio that I want to talk about this thing that he brings up. One of the things that I thought was really cool when we were doing the interview was he started talking about being the aide to General Fred Haynes.
Yeah, the tactical aide.
Right.
The operational aide.
Right. So he's riding around. So Zinni's a captain. He's the aide to General Haynes. Now, General Haynes is the Iwo Jima guy.
Yeah.
Okay? And
the same battalion as the guys who put up the flag.
Right. So he is the commandant. General Barrow, right? So the pantheon of heroes, from the pantheon, right? General Barrow walks out, and now they're riding around in the green gubby. Zinni's the aide. He's a captain. He's in the front seat, and he's listening to them talk. And he tells his story, and that's the audio that I want to play right now, and then I want to talk about it when it's done. It's about 3.5-4 minutes, like, so let me find it here, and here it is. General Zinni from that interview.
I remember when we were going to go to rooms for the troops, and I was General Haynes' aide. I was in a car with General Barrow. General Haynes and General Barrow were in the back seat. And General Barrow said, if we go to this idea of rooms, it's going to destroy the Marine Corps. Now, this is General Barrow. You know, he's a commandant of the Marine Corps. He was, you know, bigger than life. He's a great hero of our Corps. He said, we're going to lose the camaraderie and the tightness, the ability to lean on somebody else, the ability of our NCOs and others to see when something is not going quite right, to intervene. And maybe that's the intrusive leadership. We put blocks to it, the intrusive leadership. You know, I'm all for it. I think it's great that the troops have their own room now. We've come to all this. But did we break down unit cohesion? Now we pay a hell of a lot. But as a lieutenant, I barely made it payday to payday with uniform and car payments, you know. And so where did I go? I went to the club. That's where everybody went. You went to happy hour. You bonded there. Do we do that anymore? How many of our officers live off base? I remember in 1988, when General Gray came out to, CEO of 9th Marines, and he came out to watch an amphibious landing we were doing, and we were standing on the beach, and General Gray turned to me and he said, this is an historic day in the Corps. And I'm trying to think, what the hell? I'm trying to remember the Iwo Jima, you know, Guadalcanal, what the hell? And I looked at him. He says, today we crossed the line. We have more dependents than we have Marines. And now it's exponentially more. I remember in one mess, because like I told you, my first platoon, there was only two married guys. My guy, a sergeant, and my platoon sergeant. Now, when I, in one mess, I looked at the platoons to get the number married, 43, and this is now back in the 90s, 43% in the platoons were married. You know, so now, this is all good stuff. I'm not criticizing Marines getting married or Marines having rooms. But you got to understand the impact. You know, when my platoon and my squad, they were all in there. They knew each other. They knew each other personally. They knew if Lance Corporal Jones is acting a little funny and a little strange and something's going on in his life. And, you know, the fire team leaders, the corporals I had then, They could help Marines with personal problems. It didn't have to be the officer and the company commander. And they were this intrusive leadership. You didn't have to intrude. You were already there within the organization.
All right, Jeff. Thoughts on that? And so to me, it's this march from squad bays, right? That is really the way we existed as a corps for so long. Now that we don't have company formations and we pass word by text messaging.
Right. Well, I was in the Marine Corps when that happened. I mean, I was an enlisted guy when that happened. And when I first got to 3-5 after embassy duty, before that, when I went on embassy, the short time between finishing the boot camp and everything, and then going to embassy duty, I was like 9 months total, squad base the whole time. When I came back, again, we're still in squad base at Margarita, 5th Marines at Margarita.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand it anymore.
Hey, hold on. What year were you at Margarita?
I was at Margarita in 1979.
Got it.
79 to 80. And then from there, I got in the 1st Recon Battalion. I took the NDOT. I went to 1st Recon, which then was up in Talega.
Talega, right.
We were in Quonset Huts, right. You know, which is the same. Basically, it was like, it's just less room. Like, instead of a squad bay with, you know, with 50 guys in it, you had a Quonset Hut with 12, you know?
Right.
But it was the same type of thing. I remember as I was getting to be a senior sergeant, and I couldn't stand being not having privacy anymore, you know. But I have to tell you, it's true. It was definitely a problem once we went to the room thing. I didn't have to deal with rooms until I became a second lieutenant, and I'm like. And even then, when I first became a lieutenant, we were at Geiger, 8th Marines, and the men were in the squad base. And we moved from Geiger to Mainside in like November of 1988, and then we went on a MU, and we came back from the MU, the men were, you know, they're in rooms. And I don't remember it being that much of a problem because our guys had started out in squad base, if you know what I mean. And And then we were 8th Marines was the MU regiment. So when you're on ship, everybody's that squad bit thing is not only are you together, you're really together. You know? And I mean for the troops. So I didn't really start really noticing that thing until I have to tell you when it really hit home to me because of the lack of attention and detail by company grade officers and NCOs and staff NCOs. When I went and visited. My stepson was in 1-5 in 2002, right before they went over, right? Me and Lori went out there and saw them, Alpha 1-5. And it was like spick and span. The place was like, I was there for like, you know, I was there for like 10 minutes. And the company gunny from Alpha 1-5, he was in my face. His name is Gunny Bohr. He's like, and he had like this weird head shaking thing. He goes, "Can I help you, sir?" And even though I was in civilian clothes, he knew I was a Marine officer, right? And because at that time I was in charge of IOC, we were just visiting. And I said, "Yeah, I'm here for, you know, to see Corporal McCracken." And he goes, "He's on San Clemente Island right now." But what struck me was how squared away 5th Marines was then. It was Camp San Mateo. And how somebody was watching. Somebody had reported my presence. Some fucking guy, looks like an officer, walking around the company area. And there he was. Now, fast forward 3-4 years, my youngest kid of mine, Timmy's in 2-4, Paul's old battalion, long after Paul gave that up. And the place is a fucking mess. The whole camp. It's trash everywhere. I go to his BQ room, and the duty doesn't know where weapons platoon 81s really is. Some of them over here, some over there. I'm walking up and down the steps and the hallways. I finally find him. He's got a piece of cardboard taped to his door that says Kenny and like Logan and two or three other names on there. And I knock on it, and there he is. But my point is, you know, it has, I think. Actually contributed to degeneration of that type of watching out for each other. all the troops are, oh, half the troops are married now, and the rumor is a lot of them get married just to get out of the barracks. To get out of that thing they're in now, which we would have considered to be like being in a Holiday Inn, you know, when I was doing Holiday.
No, yeah. No doubt. Timmy, your thoughts on that?
Tradition in the Navy. So that would be nothing new.
Wait, hold on. Say that. I had you muted.
I was saying the phenomenon of junior enlisted guys getting married to get out of their barracks. That's a long tradition. That's been going on in the Navy when I've been in the 80s. But I must say that in 1987, when I came out to Camp Horno to 1-9, I had squad base, and I only had two married Marines, and one a corporal and one was a squad leader. But I don't want to focus on that as much as I want to focus on this aspect about the officers getting together. When my dad was in the FMF and my uncle Chad, and I remember them talking about it. Their battalion's adjutant would have officers call at the O Club on a Friday afternoon, and if you weren't there, you were getting fined, and you better have a good reason for not being there. And I remember in 1-9, on one iteration, I had two deployments that were seasoned. On one of those iterations, we had a really tight battalion staff. General Homer was the Bravo Company commander. Larry Nicholson was the Delta Company commander.
Wow.
Mike Lowe was the three. Have you remember Mike Lowe?
I don't know.
He was once our monitor when we were company grades. Big, tall, skinny guy from South Carolina. Friggin' hysterical. Not as hysterical as any, but a damn close runner-up. At any rate, when we would get together on a Friday night and go drinking, I admit, down in Mateo, I think they still had the officers' club there. We no doubt drank probably a couple of beers too many. Although there were plenty of the guys that didn't drink. But the whole time you're out there doing that, you were interacting and screwing around with each other because that's how you bond. You don't do it by sitting having reasonable conversations like we do now. I believe when we first met each other, we spent most of our time fucking around with each other. But getting to know the lay of the land, getting to know the character of the guy that you're dealing with. And that's critical because if you did that now, you held a mandatory O Club officer's call, and one of your guys has a two beers too many, done. You're finished. And I'm not glory glam. I don't hardly drink at all anymore. I'm not anybody to glamorize alcohol consumption. But goddamn it, that was important back then when I was a lieutenant. Those nights, you know, and it's not there now. And I don't know how you compensate for it.
Well, I think the point he was making that that everybody needs to give some serious thought to is how do you mitigate this, right? So, you know, life didn't change very much when I served the Marine Corps and my company at Margarita moved into the first dope smoking hotel, as my staff and sales called, right? So and then we deployed to Okinawa within 6 months, and we went into squad bays. And then I spent 2 years on ships. When we went from squad bays to high rises and rooms, we still had three formations a day. You still collided with the staff NCOs, but there was, you know, this separation now of the squad itself, of the platoon itself, which is significant. And so to me, the thing that Zinni's talking about is you've got to know that that's happening and you've got to do things to mitigate it. Right? And then so now for whatever reason on the backside of you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, we don't have formations anymore. So we've gone from squad bays, you know, to these beautiful, you know, dormitories now that colleges would envy having. And so we've created distance there. Now we don't have formations, we've created more distance. And how does it work if and it is, we don't go to the club as much. I mean, hell, there isn't even a club system like we knew. There's one all-ranks club, right, that nobody wants to go to, and everybody's living off base. So how do you think that you're going to continue to be the force that you used to be if you don't recognize these things and don't take steps to mitigate? Jeff? Go ahead, Timmy.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to point out that he gave an answer to that dilemma. Because I'll tell you right now, there are very few cohesion problems that can't be cured with 2 hours of close order drill done in a serious manner. And he was talking about winning the Rifle Company Drill Award, but Captain Tim Lynch, if you heard his older self saying this, would cringe. But I see the value in that now. I see the value of doing, if nothing else, just that, because I'll tell you quite frankly, what Vinny is, what you and I and Jeff are, we're more legionaries or centurions. We're not citizen soldiers. We're professionals. And we're rapidly finding ourselves in a position as a country to be incapable of fielding legionnaire-style professional military forces, guys who will go to Afghanistan and fight for years on end without ever bitching about it for a minute, you know? But, I mean, we're not the citizen soldier that America normally produces to answer to help her in a time of need. And you're rapidly running into a situation where you're not going to be able to sustain that. Because we, even though we weren't isolated like Zinni as lieutenants and captains, we were isolated enough. You know, I didn't spend a whole lot of time doing anything but Marine Corps shit as in my 20s and 30s. Even when I lived off base. You know, unless you count playing half-court basketball as being un-Marine-like. I mean, that was about it.
Right. You know, Matt, you kind of touched on a nerve there, and you said that a lot of these 7COs are not going to risk their career by putting their foot up somebody's ass. In other words,
right, hold on. Hold on. Before we came on the air, we were having a discussion about this, all right? And I said, you know, one of the impacts of the PAC order, right, is the prohibitive activities order, is that if I see Kenny and I say, hey, dumbass, come over here, right? I have another, if I'm a sergeant, I have a staff sergeant come up to me and like, hey, you can't haze him, you can't disrespect him. Wait, I can't call him a dumbass? No, you have to address him by his name. I mean, if we're that fucking PC and that's what we're focused on, to me, that's so fucking ridiculous, it's a joke.
Yes.
It's a fucking joke.
But I mean, I think that the broader problem is we're not, we were sent into Iraq and Afghanistan to accomplish the mission of ending, you know, the...
Hold on. I made that point, and I said the effect of that, and I've been told this by staff and COs, because I get around the Marine Corps now a little bit, right? And I was told this by somebody who works at the Academy. They won't say this for publication, but they don't believe the officer of the Marine Corps will back them up anymore. So why am I going to risk my career for Lance Corporal Kenny or PFC Lynch and stick my foot up his ass? So I'm going to do my job. I'm not going to stick my neck out. I'm not going to be accused of any of that shit and have my career ruined. I got a pretty good career right now. So now you have the problem of engagement, the problem of cohesion, and you've clipped your staff NCOs.
Right. Well, because we're not held accountable for success in combat anymore. They don't expect us. Matter of fact, the rules of engagement and things like that and the way things are set up, you almost can't achieve a decision. You couldn't achieve a decision, you know, in Iraq or Afghanistan by doing things. So taking a chance, taking a risk or anything of any kind, let alone, risk of, of enforcing discipline was just not backed up. I mean, you actually had Marines in 2013 in Helmand Province screaming to each other when they're under fire. It's not worth getting killed in Afghanistan for. I mean, I heard that myself. You know, there's nothing here worth getting killed for. The CGs were saying that stuff to guys. And what they really meant was, we don't want to lose anybody because, you know, the National Command Authority doesn't want to be embarrassed by high casualties. So we're just kind of like part of the knee-jerk weird diplomatic reactions to things. And I think that filters itself down to the troops, where pretty soon nothing's worth risking anything for. Like, you know, you want somebody to move fast, you curse at them. You maybe kick them in the ass. You got to move for your own good, for the good of all of us. But now this type of thing will get you relieved. And now, so the big quest now is to just make it to your retirement. Make it to your next promotion, which really is just another raise. And hang on as long as you can for every penny you can. You know, when I was getting ready to retire, because I had a Purple Heart, they had you go to the special, special area there in Lejeune called Intrepid Spirit. And they retested my brain and all this stuff. But there were kids in there who were claiming PTSD from SOI and getting it. And I'm like, you know, and I'm thinking, holy shit, man, what have we become? Because, you know, Tim is right about the Centurion thing, but when the Centurion's whole job is to just put forth this little effort and you don't worry about accomplishing the mission, the most important thing is that all your men are happy, or at least not unhappy, men and women, that everybody's kind of okay. You know, whereas before, how you felt was totally irrelevant. The thing was success or failure, and success, anything other than success, is just not tolerated. It's just not like that anymore. Now, you know, there's no excuse for the cross word. And so, consequently, these guys are acting exactly the way they've been trained. By they, I mean, you know, small unit leadership. They're not putting in. They're not putting out.
Okay, let me ask you a more general question. How much of our culture can the armed services absorb before we get our ass kicked?
I think we're there and past it.
Whoa, wait a second, man. Diversity is a strength.
I'm not talking about diversity. Whoa. I'm not talking about diversity. Diversity is the least...
I thought you just lost your mind.
Diversity is the least of our issues.
Sorry, I just had to bring that up. I'm sorry. To be perfectly serious, I gotta agree with Jeff. You know, I saw with great interest when I was able to hang out with you and General Furness and go around and circulate the battlefield. I saw those little combat outposts, you know, manned by lance corporals and corporals and those guys were as good as anyone that's ever come before. They were hard little fight. They were doing a great job, but it seemed to me that there was a lot of effort and put on getting those guys ready to do that for 7 months, and once they were out of there, that was it. You know, that they're going to be gone, and I don't know, because I'm not around the Marine Corps like you guys are. I don't know how they sustain that stuff, but I was impressed by what I saw in Afghanistan, and I think that if we ever come to blows again, we'll be impressed by what we produce. But how much of this can you take? How much of this silliness how long can we ignore biology? Oh, no, women can be in the infantry. I mean, that is ludicrous nonsense. And that right there,
can I tell you something? But I think that this cohesion problem is way worse. It's the single greatest threat, because you see all the different ways that it manifests itself. And the scary part is when you don't know that as an organization and aren't doing things to mitigate against it, that means you have your head up your ass.
But I would go back to General Krulak as...
Oh, fuck! Hold on. Was it General Van Riper that said it about the Crucible? No, it's Zinni. I wanted to tee this up. So, thanks, Timmy. So when General Krulak back in the 90s goes to implement the Crucible,
97,
right? The intellectual basis is there's such a delta between the Marine Corps and our culture that they're not coming to us with the values that Marines used to come to us with. So we've got to somehow or other imbue those values in them. So we're going to create an event, and it's going to be so significant in their lives, and these values that we're going to push through this event are going to consume them. Okay? And so... So to me, it's interesting. Krulak saw this in the 90s, right? And now we're talking about it low almost 20 years, or more than 22 years later, right, from the initial implementation of it. And so he had to have seen it maybe 95 before it gets implemented in 97, maybe earlier.
No, it was 97 was the first one.
No. But he had to see it and notice it and to begin the development.
He did not, see it not, when he took over Mysitic. He came out to TBS. I was an SPC with Fox Company, so you would have been an IOC, Matt. And he got in front of the lieutenants, and the very first thing he said is, "Who here doesn't think a female Marine's capable of doing anything a male Marine can?" And I remember I'm sitting with my lieutenants, and I'm looking at him like I thought someone might even like raise their hand and say, "Obviously, I do." But Kulak wasn't asking a question. He goes, "Because if you do, I'll end your Marine Corps career today." And then he starts on this, "We've got to integrate females." This is 1 month after Tailhook, brother.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of intellectual dishonesty that introduces the big lie at a very junior level. And I'm telling you right now, I'm not comfortable when I hear senior general officers talking like that. I'm very comfortable to hear him, what he was saying to General Zinni, but what he said to us in the public forum was abject bullshit.
Yeah,
and look what it's cost us.
You're right, Tim. General Furness was a captain, and in that little auditorium we had there, TBS, something hall, he stood up and went toe-to-toe with General Krulak about exactly that. And we're all waiting for Dave to be, like, kidnapped in the night by the brown shirts, you know. But, yeah, he did that, you know. But you're right about General Krulak, that whole crucible thing, it's kind of like this, and you and I talked about this, Matt, the whole thing with the human relations, which was really by this guy. We were talking about it on our way to San Diego that time. It was supposed to be like boxing and then like a group, you know, like discussion, and the way it made itself into Marine Corps was just a group discussion called
Humphrey.
Yeah.
That's right.
But Dad was integral to bringing that in and leaving out the punching part. So the crucible is a good idea, but it doesn't. But the whole point of it was not everybody's supposed to be able to make it through the crucible, but everybody makes it through the crucible. So it's not crucible is a joke of a name for it. What it does is it takes days away from SOI in order to do it. Days and money. I hate it. You know what I mean? It's like Outward Bound type crap. I don't know if you know what I'm saying? And my kids, without me even saying anything to them, all four of them, all said the same thing. It's bullshit.
And when they were dreaming that up, first off, the FMFM 0-1, which General Krulak put out as a commandant, he had been working on that at Mysitic because he pulled Paul Kennedy and me and a guy named Spike Sullivan out of AWS, and we wrote that goddamn thing, the first draft of it, which wasn't what was published. We wrote a draft of that, and because my contention was the Room of Pain was the way to go, with something similar to that, where there was in fact an exercise to which there was a point, followed by a discussion at the end, but the discussion comes after you've just thrashed your ass for 2 hours, and the guy leading the discussion was in the ring with you the entire time.
Right.
That was what we, but Krulak wouldn't do it because he was put off by the amount of violence in that little, particularly Gunny Don Vito. But we never injured a lieutenant. We never injured.
We're getting off so.
No.
But my point is that I don't care the technique that you use to create cohesion. The lack of identifying that as a problem, right? And I'll throw this one out again. You know, Dave Furness lights off this huge debate in the Marine Corps about discipline. And only one other general officer speaks publicly about it. Right? That's in my opinion, that's scary shit.
Yeah, it is.
Nobody can admit that which is most obvious to fucking everybody?
Yeah.
Hackworth wrote a book about it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, there has to be, and General Zinni touched on it in the interview with you, Mac. He talks about, you know, discipline is more than just, it's not about punishment.
Right.
It's about a sense of personal responsibility. And that's the thing that he had from, he talks about going to Catholic school and just about life growing up in the, you know, the 40s and 50s there in, you know, Philly, in the type of family background he had, where they had to have, you know, they had to have that, you had, there's, you had your rights, but that's the whole thing about rights too. That's not really stressed. You for, with rights comes responsibility. The responsibility is more important.
Okay, so
our
let me ask you.
At the thought that we would inconvenience or bother somebody during a dinner in a restaurant more than they ever would the service that we got as kids.
Right. If you if you're responsible for things. If out of 100%, you growing up, explain what percentage was your rights and what percent was your responsibility.
Yeah, it seems like 95% responsibility and 5% right.
Okay, give me a right you had as a little kid growing up.
The right to have chow 3 times a day.
Tim, give me a right you had growing up when you were a kid.
I had the right to go to my bedroom and go to sleep when I was told to.
That's a good one.
I can't even. Yeah. I can't even think of something that I would tell you that corporal punishment Kathleen told me was my right as a kid. I was obligated to do what the fuck she said when she told me to do it. And if I ever didn't do that when somebody told me to do it, there it was, we joke about it, right? There was no discussion about my coach is an idiot or my teacher stupid.
Yeah.
You were going to get your ass kicked. And all they had to do was rat your ass out.
Yep.
So, and so to me, it's just right. You know, and that's why the thing Frankel says about, you know, that he believes there ought to be a statute of responsibility on the west coast of the United States to balance out the Statue of Liberty on the east coast. And here, again, in a completely separate vein, we're talking about the same kind of shit. And that's what that cohesion has to deliver for the organization, and not just for the Marine Corps. The Navy's dying for it. The Air Force is dying for it. And it's a component of post-traumatic winning. Knowing them, caring about them, creates that cohesion and stops the suicide. And I'll tell you what, and I need to write it, but to me, the suicide issue in the DOD is a leadership issue. It's isolated. They come in looking for something that they saw advertised, looking to be part of something good, part of something great. And what do they find? They find nothing, right? Or not what they thought. And now they're just in this caste system getting fucked with. So why would I smuggle people across the border for $1,000 a shot? Why fucking not?
Yeah.
Really?
That's where you're at? I tell you right now, the issue we're dealing with is was framed by Fehrenbach in the 60s as we won't allow our military leaders to treat our troops as a tough college football coach would treat his team. And in fact, a college football coach who was as lax with his team as we are with the troops would soon find himself out of a job.
Right.
Because everybody understands what it takes to be a good college team.
Well, and why would the college football coach be fired?
Because he would not lose.
He would lose.
And we're paying for the highest stakes that can ever be, but nobody can make that connection. And I was kind of getting around to what I wanted to stress was the only antidote in my mind, aside from close order drill, which I would encourage now, is in fact post-traumatic winning, because it's the only mechanism that's out there that's telling you to get involved in your fucking subordinate's life, because it's your job, goddammit. It was not a mystery to me as a second lieutenant that I had to know what was going on with my troops, but they were all sitting right there in front of me every day. It wasn't hard to do, you know? But so now how are you going to substitute for that? Well, you don't have the money that an NCAA Division I college football team has to lavish on the players to build cohesion, so you got to do it yourself on the cheap. Close order drill and PTW. It's the only thing I could see that would work.
They would laugh at you if you scheduled close order drill.
Oh, everybody laughs at you until they've done it a couple times.
Well, and you
know, because nobody wants to look like an idiot when they're drilling. Once you're out there doing it, nobody wants to look fucked up.
Yeah,
you know who has that? Jim Bathurst, who I've right. Jim Bathurst is one of those guys who went from E1 to O6. He didn't make it to O4, but I mean, and he had this incredible career, and he told me, he said, you know, the first thing I do when I took over, and he went from command to command. His career is crazy. He said, I'd look and see how much close order drill is on the schedule. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, look, close order drill, one, it makes somebody be in charge. It makes somebody publicly be in charge. They have to give orders. Other people follow orders. He said, it's the way it works. And he said, show me a unit that doesn't do close order drill, and I'll show you a gaggle. Because the leaders don't have to publicly be in charge. They slime around, and they don't act like leaders. And all of a sudden, you start doing those things, and guess what happens? People start giving orders. People start acting like leaders. He said, it's one of the components that I measure a unit by. Now, it's a quaint thing that the Marine Corps used to do, and you got to do before a change of command so you don't walk out there and look stupid.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I mean, so anyway.
This company did it. Nicholson's company did it all the friggin' time.
I had to drill these guys everywhere. Matter of fact, when I was at OCS, I drilled the whole fucking golf company. 200 and some guys up from that white elephant up to the chow hall. Because once they stopped fucking with me for being a gunny who was going through OCS, they just said, hey, Kenny, take them to chow.
Hey, you can drive a platoon in the wrong way. How many times have you seen that? I've done that once when you screwed up your commands because the boys are marching. They'll march right into walls and shit if you fuck up. I've done that before. Man, because it is easy to do.
That's funny to watch, though. You have to
remember. Oh, it is funny. You know, when somebody fucks it all up. No, that's hysterical.
Yeah, when you start playing train wrecks. And again, what we're talking about is this whole discussion about from squad bay to no formations and text messaging. And the cost of that is the cohesion. And when you're not a cohesive unit, you might win, but there's going to be a lot of people that get dead and that whose bodies get destroyed that don't have to get dead and whose bodies don't have to be destroyed because you weren't as good as you could have been. And so to me, pretty scary that the institution isn't accountable for that. And isn't taking concrete measures that it's more important that everybody's happy and that nobody gets called nobody gets called glasses or wing nut because their ears are too fucking big. Harry Frank, lieutenant type in my basic school class, right? I don't know if he went to IOC. He might have gone to IOC now that I think about it. Anyway, it's like our first or second day, and they're looking for Lieutenant Frank, right? So somebody's like, hey, where's Lieutenant Frank? And so we turn around, and his nickname was Wingnut, right? But, you know, once somebody's nickname becomes their name, you don't even notice it, right?
That's it. That's right? Exactly right.
Like, where's Frank? And then you turn around and say, Wingnut! And then they looked and said, what'd you just say? And I was standing there. They weren't talking to me. And whoever they're talking to says, Wingnut? And then Frank comes around the corner, and the guy looks at Frank, and he just starts fucking laughing. And he looks back at us, and he goes, that's awesome.
Yeah. Listen to this. When I was a sergeant, I was the super squad guy for 3-5, and we lost. And we became state platoon. And I had this kid of my Lance Corporal, very good, named Dave DeLuna. A Mexican kid from Brownsville, Texas. And he's one of those red-headed Mexicans, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was the only guy who was married in the whole platoon, including me. I wasn't married then. And so one time he says, hey, Sergeant Kenny, Gina, you know, his wife Gina was pregnant. He goes, I got to take Gina to the hospital. He was like also our mule and jeep driver. We had mules in those days. I don't know if you guys remember that.
They were awesome.
Yeah, so I go, yeah, and so one of the other guys I had, McIntyre, who also is from Philly, he goes, well, is DeLuna bitching again? DeLuna never bitched. But he got the nickname Bitch DeLuna after that. And everybody called him Bitch DeLuna. Matter of fact, like 2 months later, the phone rings, and so he says, hey, Sergeant Kenny, you got a phone call, it's Gina. She goes, Sergeant Kenny, is Bitch there? This is her husband she's talking about, right? He wasn't a bitch. But you're right, Mac. It became his name, right? to where Colonel Williams, a Dido company commander. Okay, you guys get the mule. I want you guys to, I want State Platoon up here. Can Bits drive this mule? Yes, sir. Everybody, because he was like a redheaded, orange complexion Mexican guy. Very smart, always there, never complained. But he got that name, Bitch DeLuna, and it was his name forever.
That is hilarious.
That's a good one.
No, but it's, I'll tell you what, it, honestly, and it's scary. And it's scary. And that's why I asked, you know, how much of this culture can we absorb? A culture that doesn't do adversity, that doesn't do consequences. How much can we bend over to placate that culture? And that's why I think that PAC order ought to be rescinded, right? Most of that stuff is contained in other orders, right? And look, we know the difference between hazing and calling somebody glasses or dumbass or whatever. Okay, that, and the line between those two isn't thin. It's pretty fucking thin. But when a staff sergeant or a sergeant in the Marine Corps can't do the same shit that goes on at every construction site, right, across the country to get shit done on a daily basis, you're in fucking trouble.
Yeah.
You're in fucking trouble. Anyway, all right, final thoughts. Timmy?
My final thoughts are we're in trouble, but we're not in trouble with 50 guys sitting in northern Syria getting captured. So that's one small reward we have.
We got to go back there.
I won't go there, but I agree. the nickname thing is just kicking my head for a long time. Paul Kennedy called every lieutenant named Richards that we got Dick Richards, and I continued it to where there's like three or four lieutenants who are now like lieutenant colonels in the Marine Corps. Everybody still calls them Dick, even though their name is Roger.
But you know, it was about busting balls and having a good time, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly the point.
We had Lieutenant Blaya, and they called him Princess Blaya.
He was my XO in 1A. Princess Blaya. He had Princess Blaya all the way through until he made captain.
He's probably like the president of IBM, and they still call him Princess Blaya. That is back.
Oh yeah, and he loved it. I mean, at first he didn't. He used to turn red as a beet.
I know.
But by the time I got to the FMF, I remember I show up and there's Blaya. I'm like, Princess. And the lieutenants just start busting up laughing.
Right.
And I remember him.
That's funny. Now, let me tell you, I mean, it's you hear, that's why, you know, this stuff is so, I think, so good to do. And it was really cool when I was talking to Joe Van Riper before we went on. He said to me, Mac, he said, I didn't realize how many people listen to your podcast. And now, I didn't really know what to say, if I should be like my bombastic asshole self and say, what are you kidding me, sir? Everybody listens. So I didn't, you know, because Jerome Van Riper still intimidates me to this day.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And
me too.
And so he says, but I went up there for the 30th anniversary of the founding of the Marine Corps University, and General Mattis spoke, and he was a keynote speaker, and General Gray spoke too. And he said, I had people come up to me the whole time I was there, asking, you know, talking to me, wanting to talk to me about the interview. He said, I tell you, he said, you've done a great job with spreading the word for this. And he said, I'm really impressed. And so after we did the thing, I said, hey, so would you consider, you know, you and General Zinni coming on, and I'll tee it up and you guys can have at it? And about, because it's, you guys are good friends and you argue about a lot of stuff. And he said, how about this? We want to argue about, did the Marine Corps do maneuver warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan? He said, I say we did. Tony says we didn't. I said, I agree with Tony. And he said, regardless of that, he said, if we could get a third, you know, a retired, you know, general officer or somebody. So I texted Paul Kennedy, and I said, do you think you're intellectually deep enough to be in a roundtable with Zinni and Van Riper? He said, buddy, are you kidding me? He said, I want to be in on that. And I saw, but I was like so deep, right? That Ben Riper would suggest that. And he said, and maybe, you know, we could get John Schmidt on another time with us and talk about the development of FMF1 and where it needs to go from where it started, you know, 30 years ago. You know, because Ben Riper, who's a huge command and control guy, right? You know, he was like, what, C4, I2? He was a, you know, he was one that I think initiated the I and all of that. I was like, how cool is that stuff going to be? When you can sit down and have that kind of intellectual discourse and with guys like that. So.
Hey, I saw Paul Kennedy go toe to toe with General Zinni when we were in AWS, because I remember all these field grade officers being distinctly uncomfortable at the tone and the vehemence in which they were arguing. I don't even remember what it was over, but they were enjoying the hell out of it. They were enjoying each other. Because Paul, as I'm sure you're shocked to hear, wasn't backing down from his point.
No, but you know what, Paul,
I'd love to hear that.
Paul had been around Zinni enough to know that Zinni loves that, right?
Yeah. Paul knew. Paul knew much better than I think everybody was casually watching. But to hear Paul, and because if we were going to talk about China, I was going to bring up Ben Riper. When's the last time that we lost a carrier in a war game? It was when we were fighting Ben Riper. And what did they do to beat Ben Riper? They redid the game. They just told him to stop it and go home. So Ben Riper has got a serious point to play in our future discussions about the Chinese situation because of his adept abilities as being an op four commander. I mean, I'm so impressed by the guy, and I was so terrified of him when I knew him. It's ridiculous.
He was a terrifying guy. But you know what? Had we got to know him better, right? Had we heard about Mike Company, you know, we would not have been afraid. Because when you talk to him, you see how much he loves the, you know, being a centurion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you guys say that, too, because he had a reunion of those Mike Company guys in the summer of 91, and I was just took over Weapons Platoon EI Company, and we did the stack display there in the armory for them. And, I mean, they're all right up there, and I'll tell you, a bunch of dudes and, you know, polo shirts and Bermuda shorts and shit, you know, getting a little longer in the tooth. And he was, like, totally relaxed. He's wearing slacks and a polo shirt, you know. And,
right.
I was, like, terrified that one of my guys would shave and fire me right there. Trying to get like, the lowest rung of the TVS instructor ladder anyway. Well, you're fired from this. You're now the BOQ officer. Get out of here.
So, final question, go around. Zinni talks about he doesn't like, you know, the reason he doesn't like lists is that they're top down, tools, and he wants it to come bottom up. And you know, you have guys like Mattis who publish lists, guys like Ben Riper, guys like Dave who publish lists. A final thought, where do you fall out in that spectrum, Jeff?
Well, I think you give your guys a chance to prove they don't need those, but when they don't perform, and that's, I think, what happened with, I know it's what happened with Second Mardiv and Don Furness, and I'm thinking now that's probably what happened with General Van Riper and Second Marine Division, you know, and those other guys, too. They just weren't getting through, so they did it and forced it, you know, and then people got the idea finally.
Right. Timmy?
I'd like to think I was more of a Zinni-style leader, but to be perfectly honest, I don't think I have his capabilities. I would have benefited by being a list guy, but I mean, I only commanded at the company command level, so it wasn't really relevant. Had I gone on to be a battalion regimental guy, I would have benefited from being a list kind of guy, but I don't think I would have done that because my natural inclination was not to.
Here's something that I learned, and I'm trying to remember. I should be able to, if I sat here and thought about it, I could tell you the specific incidents that taught me this. But a technique is neither good nor bad, right? A technique is...
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
I'll tell you what it was. It was developing the decision class. And I wanted to teach, you know, I wanted to look at analytical decision making as opposed to recognition prime decision making. So I got the Marine Corps staff planning process that got used in World War II. And you should see this fucking thing, man. It takes up the whole slide, and it starts with small boxes in the lower left-hand corner, and it goes, like, diagonally to the right, and then it goes back diagonally to the left. And that's what, that's the process, right?
And so, all that just for two up and one back.
Right? So analytical... analytical decision making, boom, this is how we did it in World War II, right? Collected groan, okay? And then you put up tic-tac-toe, recognition prime decision making. You know, what's X next move? Everybody goes, right there, okay? You know, which one's better? And then you have people, you know, recognition. It's like, wait a minute, see this cumbersome one, this big one? This one fucking World War II. And so what I learned was the technique is neither good nor bad. It's the misapplication of the technique to an inappropriate situation and then doing it without the appropriate footnotes that winds up killing the technique. So to me, what Zinni does, and first of all, Zinni is not having, right? He's not going to be a loser, and he's not going to lose, right? He's going to tell you what he wants, and he's going to be all over you, teaching you more classes than you've ever had in your life, right? He's going to be, quote-unquote, mentoring you, and he's going to drag you down the fucking trail whether you want to or not. Now, whether he uses a list or not, or a letter about staff NCOs, you could split that hair. And I think the technique, if you have to use a list, then fucking use a list. If you think that makes them better, if you think that's significant, you know, there's nothing, I don't see that there's anything wrong with it. But what you have to do is you got to be out there, you got to be visible, you got to articulate your vision, you got to be a human being, and you got to dominate that gray area, you got to dominate that intervening terrain so they fucking know. And if you do that, and if you do that and you love them, it does, you know, then it's all good.
And so, to be fair, the only one of them who is validated is General Mattis, because none of those guys saw any action above the company level besides him. It's all theory. It's all exercises.
Wait a minute. Dave?
No, but Mattis's performance, I think, validates a lot of Mattis, his theories.
You're talking Mattis, Van Riper, General Zinni and General Van Riper, they never were in any kind of action above company level.
Right.
I mean, I'm not saying they're not great. I'm just saying they never were in the game. You know, General Mattis commanded the 1st Marine Division in Iraq during tough times. Both those times were tough for different reasons, you know.
But he didn't publish anything like that when he was a division commander.
Right.
He published as the MEF commander. So, you got to publish these chicken shit rules, blah, 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 blah.
Well, that's not true.
Yeah, the whole, to me, the answer to that is, look, if you know these dudes, right?
Right.
This is not where they started, right? This is not where they started. This was not the first attempt at this. Trust me, if you know those guys,
right?
They believe in bottom up leadership, but the bottom line is we're gonna fucking win. And if I can't get you there bottom up, right, then I'll get you there top down. I fucking know that. But the bottom line is we're going there.
Yeah, you gotta know your men and employ them according to their capabilities. Absolutely.
There you go. So and you know what? That's what I love about this shit. We've been, you know, the three of us have been doing this since like 1990 is when we started doing this shit. So we've been going on 30 years, you know. And Zinni and in fact, it was interesting. One of the interesting things Joe Van Riper said about when I asked him, "When did you meet Zinni?" He said, "Well, you know, we were both captains, and he was junior to me. But every time I was around him, I learned a lot."
Yeah.
Right? Like, this Zinni guy, you know, he's not as senior as I am, but, you know, he's a pretty smart guy. And that's our experience together is all of our friends are smart. They're smart. Honestly, they're smart centurions who are devoted to the craft, you know, the we devoted ourselves to. So, and then these discussions are the, I mean, as you can tell, I like them a lot. So
yeah, you can't, you never know what you know until we until you start talking to somebody who knows more than you.
Well, and then it's so fun to sit there and whether it's the footnotes or whatever the hell it is listen to somebody disagree with you and footnote yep. it, or, and then, you know, because Jeremy Van Riper was interesting because he came on and said, yeah, there's not as much daylight as you might think. And that's the part of the discussion I really like. It's like, okay, now we're gonna get to the NASA ass. Now we're gonna get to the footnotes. Now we're gonna see what is the difference. And you find out, you know what? Style, not that significant, right? But getting there is significant. So
yeah, one way or the other. Yeah. I'll leave you with one last piece of trivia, if you don't mind.
Not a bit.
Do you know what John Dillinger's last words were?
No.
Don't put it in a jar, whatever you do.
No, I just read a book about it. In the movie with Johnny Depp, he says Blackbird, you know, the reference to his girlfriend. That was really a lie to get her to talk if there's any more info. Because all that money that him and his partner stole, like almost $400,000, almost none of it was recovered. But what he really said when one of those gunmen shot him, I mean, they had these special Western gunfires because the FBI were just shooting each other and shooting innocent people and shit like that. But the guy, what he said was, I am not dressed for this occasion. And that's a true story. He got shot in the head and he said, as he's dying, I am not dressed for this occasion.
That's a man way too concerned with his public image right there.
There you go. There you go. On that, I'm speechless. I didn't know what to say. The thanks for the visit.
Thank you, Mac. Always enjoy doing this. Enjoy the hell out of it.
Awesome. That's Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch. More Bomberman Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the Warrior Radio Network. That'll do it on a Thursday. Selective moral outrage is cowardice. If you believe in shit, then you should live up to it. Memo to Nike, memo to Colin Kaepernick. Have the courage to live up to the shit that you say publicly. But we all know that that's not going to happen. So, interesting stuff going on relative to the National Basketball Association. And again, something that we talk about, which is the whole China, you're going to dance to our fucking tune. And you're going to dance to our tune in your country. Yeah, well, the answer to that is, hey, fuck you, man. I'm not. But then I'm making millions of dollars. So now my morals collide with my bank account. That's when you find out who's moral. Anyway, I love these discussions with my friends, just for the record. I mean, they're smart guys, they're fun guys, and, you know, they've led intellectually vigorous lives. I mean, they love this subject matter. For whatever reason, we have that in common. And so discussing this kind of stuff with them is always, 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 always a great time. If you are just tuning in, don't touch that dial. Another awesome show in a week of awesome shows. If you haven't listened to much this week, on Monday, Matt Kiker, listen to him. This kid's a stud. I met him 10 months ago, and his father committed suicide on the phone with him and his mother and his brother when he was 9 years old. His uncle had murdered his wife by that time. Another uncle hit and killed by a car. In sixth grade, his best friend hangs himself. His brother commits suicide, and then after Matt buries him, he finds out that his brother and the girl he asked to marry him were having an affair. A lot when you're not 22 years old yet. So listen to his interview on Monday. And then on Tuesday, General Van Riper, the interview that we just talked about, or General Zinni's interview. General Zinni's, he's awesome, man. He's a smart, personable, funny. And the interview is a great interview. And then General Van Riper comes on at the end, and I say, hey, you know, what do you have to say about this? And which I love that. So anyway. And then in hour one, though, we'll talk about, you know, the game China plays and now watching the NBA try to dance to it in public. And again, here's the problem the NBA has. The majority of the players of the National Basketball Association are black American men, right? They grew up in the black culture. They know the struggle, their own struggle, to be free economically, educationally, socially. They know that struggle. And they're going to turn their back on China, on Hong Kong. And they're going to shut up, right? Watch what happens. If you're in a group of black men and somebody tells somebody to shut up, watch what happens. They don't play that game in public. So there's going to be a fight. And so it'll be interesting to see how the National Basketball Association deals with getting told to shut up about people trying to be free. And a sport dominated by black Americans, with their life experience, if they do shut up. So, we'll be watching. Anyway, have a great day. On a Thursday, Almond Radio. Over and out.